I'm incredibly delighted to be here with you reading at the Poetry Center. I have been so inspired by my students this semester in both my translation class and my fiction workshop. It is just such a thrill and an honor to be here sharing this literary haven with such thoughtful, intelligent writers. So thank you all for being part of this artistic community that we all create together. I'm going to read from my most recent novel, The Gods of Tango, which actually that 17 languages of translation, I've been very fortunate with my own work having been rendered into that many languages, but the number actually this week went up to 18 because the rights to this book were sold in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Wow. So that's, Bosnian is a new realm for that, to update the website. Before I go into the novel, I'm going to read something that is sort of in the spirit of the literary translation part of what I do and part of that piece of the conversation with students here. I do translate other people's work, poetry, stories, novels, but this was sort of an interesting case in which I wrote a poem in Spanish and then rendered it into English myself. This is a poem that I wrote the day after finding out about the Orlando shooting. And I found myself, you know, the Sunday that the news broke, I just had to sort of stay alive and take my kids to their play dates. And I sort of couldn't think. I just had to hold it together. And the moment I dropped off my my oldest son, I just fell apart and, you know, tried to catch up on social media and tried to let in this event that had happened, which of course comes on the heels of so many other new pieces of news of great violence and brutality and heartlessness that we, of course, have all been hearing about in our society. And there was one thing that a friend posted on Facebook. She wrote, she's a queer Latina woman, and she wrote, "Estos son nuestros." These are ours. And she posted a link to a description of the folks who died in the shooting and all of these beautiful Latino names and all of these beautiful, you know, Latino queer bodies and people. Every death, of course, was tragic, no matter who the person was. And there was also something about this haven specifically for queer Latino people, feeling the ripple effects that invasion was going to have in communities where havens mean so much. And so something happened inside me where I couldn't speak, and I tried to write, and I couldn't write in English, and my English just sort of collapsed. And I found that I could only speak in Spanish. I could only be in Spanish in attempting to name and move through this grief. So I, not being a poet, accidentally wrote this poem. And I will read it to you in Spanish, and then I will read it to you in the English translation. So this is Para Orlando. A veces el inglés se fuma. A veces el inglés no abarca el alma. Por ejemplo, para decir mi dolor por los muchachos en Orlando, para decir los nombres latinos entre ellos, para decir la hermosura de sus ojos, bailes, deseos, la hermosura radiante así de sus deseos, para transmitir cuánto ya sabían del odio y de cómo amar un cuerpo, un ser, tengo que aullar en español. Pero ojo, el inglés musculoso también nos nutre. El inglés y el español intercambian palabras como ropa entre primas o primos también. El español, jugando con el inglés, explorando prendas y verdades, sacó del closet la palabra gay y se la puso para siempre. I should say to Uruguay, Uruguay is my nation of origin, and in Uruguay people use the word, when you ask, what is the word people use for themselves in Spanish in Uruguay? They say gay, soy una persona gay. So this word has been sort of borrowed from English. For Orlando. Sometimes English collapses. Sometimes English can't contain the soul. For example, to speak my pain for the young folks in Orlando, to say the Latino names among them, to speak the beauty of their eyes, dance, desires, the radiant beauty, yes, of their desires, to convey how much they already knew of hate and of how to love a body, a being. I have to howl in Spanish, but careful, muscular English nurtures us too. English and Spanish exchange words like clothes between cousins of any gender. Spanish playing with English, exploring garments and truths, took from the closet the word gay and put it on forever. Okay, so now I'm gonna move us to The Gods of Tango, to my most recent novel. And I'm gonna read from three shorter pieces from different moments in the book. In this novel, I started this novel knowing I wanted to write about migration, immigrants, particularly the immigrant wave that really shaped Argentina and Uruguay at the beginning of the 20th century. My great-grandparents were part of that wave. And I wanted to also use that to tell a larger story myself as an immigrant to this country and having immigrated various times in my childhood. I wanted to tell a larger story about what it is to be an immigrant, to enter a culture that is and is not yours, to hold a culture in your skin that isn't in the world around you, and how that story is also a story of cultural creativity and contribution to the society where you land. The tango is a prime example of that. It was born from the collision and interaction of cultures, of so many immigrants from so many places, of Afro-Argentines, of criollo gauchos. That cauldron really gave rise to the tango, which has been very stereotypically portrayed in the United States and I would say in the so-called first world. And that piece, the sort of multicultural roots of this tango, I hadn't seen it told. So I wanted to get into that. I also have this protagonist who's a young immigrant woman at 17. She can't survive alone in Buenos Aires, so she passes as a man, dresses as a man, and becomes a tango violinist. In a time when only men could play the tango, the very early 20th century, it was very much a macho underworld, and she enters that underworld and also comes to grips with her attraction to women. And so there's also very much a sort of coming into herself as queer theme. So this first thing I'm going to read is just from her point of view. She starts as Leda, now she's living as Dante, and this is just a little bit of what it's like to sort of be her while she's passing as a man. On some nights, Dante fell into sleep like a dead weight, but on others, she lay awake, restive, aching. Loneliness wrapped tightly around her throat, a thin wire, fatal. There was nobody who saw her as she truly was. There was no end to the disguise, to the invented story. It was not that she didn't want to live as this new Dante, but in hiding half of her story, she became unseen, or half-seen, like the moon when it veils one side of its face in darkness. And there were times when she wanted to be seen, even touched, but these things were not possible. She brushed them off. She was glad no one could see her, that she was invisible in full view. It was her salvation. People cannot see what they can't imagine, and she was unimaginable, even to herself, a kind of rip in the fabric of reality. Women had never done such things before, had they? Only the violin accepted her fully, without question. At times, she would imagine that when she played the violin, someone or something else was playing her with the same fierce care, using her to fulfill its inscrutable vision. She, nothing more than an instrument of the divine, perhaps, though not the God of priests in the Bible, from whose embrace she was surely excommunicated by her sins. There had to be some other force that was also divine, or at least felt so, perhaps originating among lax angels or bold demons, or some creature that fused them both within herself. An angel demon, a spiritual hermaphrodite, exiled from heaven just like her, entirely awake. Only that kind of God would deign to fill a vessel like Leda, who was Dante, pour in through the crown of her head while she played, and rush down her arms through her fingers to strings that moaned beautifully, not for her alone, but for all the secret exiles here on earth. Home still pulled at her ankles, a riptide strong enough to drown in. She tried not to think of it, tried not to miss Alazzano, tried to ignore its imprint behind her eyelids when she blinked, but it was always there, always throbbing beneath the surface, always beckoning to her, threatening the ground on which she stood. Sometimes, Lyra dreamt of Vesuvius, that she was climbing its slopes on bare feet. Her feet bled, but it didn't hurt her. She walked and walked until the volcano erupted with what looked at first like lava, but on her arriving closer, revealed itself to be a glowing river of people pouring down the mountain on all sides, droves and droves of immigrants flying past her with startled expressions on their faces as the victims of Pompeii might have had. Except, unlike those ancient victims, these people were alive, completely alive, arms outstretched in a futile attempt to hold on to something, anything, a branch, a rock, a memory, as they soared down slopes and out to the horizon, which swallowed them by the thousands, leaving not a single trace. Most of this book is from Leda Dante's point of view, but I also made a decision early on, and we've talked a lot about point of view and polyphonic novels in my fiction workshop. I'm trying to see Kayla's in my fiction workshop. And so I really wanted this to not only be her story, because it was that sort of larger cauldron that gave birth to the tango, broader story that I wanted to also capture. So once in every chapter, the narration slides into the point of view of someone else. So I'm going to actually read a couple of short pieces from the point of view of other characters to kind of bring that mosaic in a little bit. And this character, this is one of the prostitutes that Leda encounters in one of these seedy underworld places where the tango is played. She struggles very much with her attraction to women and with her knowledge that these prostitutes have constrained circumstances. And this young girl was trafficked from Poland, and this is just a little moment in her mind. Sexual trafficking from Poland was part of the story of Buenos Aires at the time. An easy boy, this one, the girl thought as she approached the bar. He didn't seem violent, not yet, and might even be a little scared. The scared ones were easier, except when fear turned mean, which made for the worst customers of all. It had been a decent night so far. There were no new bruises, and the man she'd just left had been quick, rote, muttering in a language she didn't recognize and so easily ignored. In her 3 years in Argentina, she'd spread her legs for every language on earth, or, at least, many more languages than she'd known existed as a little girl. She spoke Spanish now, but not the other tongues. She didn't want to know them, wanted the men's voices to wash over her like water over rocks, rushing, senseless, soon gone. She never spoke Polish anymore. Polish was a secret language locked up in a box deep in her mind. She refused to open it, her one rebellion. The worst men were not the ones who beat her or the ones who tore her that place and made it hurt for days. The worst men were the Poles who tried to speak to her. She pretended they were wrong, shook her head as if she didn't understand. "What are you?" they asked. "A mute? A Russian?" Some gave up. They weren't there to talk after all, but others got angry and tried to punch her into answering, but they always lost the fight. She always won. She would not do it. The box would stay locked up until she died. She dreamed of death the way other girls her age dreamed of marriage. When she died, she'd have to go to hell. She didn't fear it anymore. She'd already seen it. But first, she'd march up to the gates of heaven and open her Polish, open her mouth, pour words between the golden bars to Yahweh and all the archangels so they could tremble at what she had to say. Because she'd say everything then. She wouldn't hold back. She'd dare to call God by his name and spit through the gates and shout, "Where were you? Have you seen your cursed America?" And if they listened, those archangels, Michat, Gabriel, Rafat, she'd send them down to tear the faces off the men who'd carried her across the ocean. "She'll see the world," the stranger said to her father, and his gold rings glinted in the firelight. Her father stared at his visitor's black suit, tailored in a modern fashion never seen before in the village, no doubt the finest clothing Warsaw had to offer. He seemed proud of the visit and dwarfed by it, a peasant called on by a king. She was at the edge of the room, crushing dried marjoram with a pestle beside her mother. Matka was separating dough into strands to braid into challah for Shabbat. She looked tired, Matka. She was always tired. She'd borne 11 children. And you, she always said, are the most difficult. You're a colt who needs breaking. Your poor husband will have a hard job. But she said none of this to the stranger when he spoke of taking her pretty girl, and so he said it, your pretty girl, to the new world, where a husband would be waiting. The stranger paid her father a dowry fit for a princess, or so it seemed, and also promised to pay for her bridal gown, travel, food, and shelter until her wedding day. Since then, she'd seen the ocean from the deck of a great ship and seen also many dim rooms that filled too fast with men. There was no wedding. The first weeks were the worst because the colt still rose in her and forced the men to teach her a lesson and another, lessons that broke the skin and filled every orifice she had. She was a field full of holes. She was a poisoned field where nothing would ever grow again. That was 3 years ago. Now it was better. There were nights like this when she felt almost nothing at all. She rarely went outside, but she didn't miss the sun. She didn't want heat, didn't want to be exposed. She missed the cold of home, deep winter, hot red broth, fire crackling in the oven, skins and wool and furs to enfold you, soft layers between you and the world. When she dared to dream, she dreamed of snow. Snow casting itself across the fields to hide the broken earth. Snow alighting on each branch in fragile benediction. Snow to force the bears into their caves. Snow on roofs as if to wash them. Snow before the footprints, before the mud and ice, as far as the eye can see, a hush of white. And when her room became unbearable, she didn't bear it at all. She dissolved from her body and the city and America itself and reappeared in the most perfect moment of her life. She was 8 years old, out to fetch water in the first snow of winter, stealing a glance at the field. It was so entrancing, crisp and pure and quiet, that it took her a moment to see the miracle. A kropiatka bird perched in the whiteness, so light he left no footprint. Nobody would believe her if she told. The kropiatka bird migrated in the fall, and it was never seen in winter. Surely his brethren were all gone by now. But here he was, and he did not act lost. He trilled with shocking joy. She couldn't take her eyes off this brazen little bird, the most beautiful creature she'd ever seen. So full of spring that he sang in the face of everything, the loss of his flock, a buried field, the dark about to come. I'm just going to read one more very brief piece. And this is from the point of view of the man who is the leader of the band that Dante ends up joining, an orchestra of tango. And it begins in the city cabarets and then makes its way to the sort of elite northern side of Buenos Aires as the aristocracy begins to pay attention to this tango dance that they had once disdained. The leader of the band, Santiago, is an Afro-Argentine man, and it was important to me to include his voice and a component from his point of view because of the tremendous contribution that Afro-Argentines made to the tango and to Buenos Aires and Argentinian Rioplatense culture, which is a history that is, perhaps this is a longer conversation, but a history that is still deeply under-acknowledged in Argentina today. A music born among the children of slaves is like an orphan. It will never know its real parents, will never hear the full visceral story of its birth. That's what his uncle Palo had told him. Paolo used to drum when Santiago was a boy, every night after dinner and for hours on Sundays, on drawers turned upside down, on barrels salvaged from the port, drumming as if the slap of palms on hard things could fill his children's bellies for the night, though it could not, as if the dead gathered in a circle around him, listening and reveling and stepping in time. And there were so many dead. Paolo's three older brothers had died in the Paraguayan War, conscripted by the Argentinian government, taken off by force with all the black men of their generation, because, Paolo told young Santiago, they needed a way to not only win their war, but also rid this country of us in the process. Two birds with one stone. Buenos Aires was too black for them. One third of the population? That's enough blackness to swallow you up, get strong on you. And so they sent our fathers off to war and opened floodgates to European steamships so that white men would pour into the city to replace us. And their plan worked, the bastards. Look at our city now. Look at San Telmo. It's like an outpost of Italy around here. Not that I'm complaining. Your father was a good man, and if he hadn't come here from Florence, he wouldn't have met my sister, and you wouldn't have been born. History is dirty, but you're a good thing to come out of it. One of the best. Uncle Paolo lived to the age of 62 when pneumonia tore through the conventillo and took many small children and old men. Santiago was 33 then. At the burial, as the men of his family shoveled redolent dirt over the coffin, he thought of Paolo Torres and the world that would soon forget him, forget his name, the sound of his voice, his drumming, his steps on cold flagstone. Paolo, a giant of a man, condemned to erasure from the books of time. Santiago pledged then, spade in hand, to take Torres as his stage name and to make music with such ferocity that his name would force itself into the world of tango, or, if not his name, at least his sound, which carried Paolo's sound under the surface. And this was the commitment that fueled him still, kept him striving even when the odds seemed insurmountable. He never married, and now, at 39 years old, he still couldn't think of marriage, for fear a wife might split his heart away from music, blunt his hunger. Sometimes, when he was tired and the other members of his band had gone back home, he wondered why he was doing all of this and whether he should give up the fight, maybe find a wife and settle down into a life of nights by the hearth with a full belly and feet up, children other than the scattered bastards he suspected might be his but had never seen. Children who could climb all over him and accost him with shouts of delight. And in those moments of doubt, he called up his uncle's voice, saying, "The tango is ours. Remember that. Remember where it came from. For every person who knows the roots of tango, there will be 100 people who do not. And maybe, one day, those who do know will all disappear. But the secret lives on. It beats in the drum, and in these syncopations, even when the drum is gone. In the steps of dancers who'll never know they're mimicking the steps of an old religion that arrived here in the festering bellies of slave ships like the only bright thing left in hell. A god and goddess dancing side by side, the way they used to do before the tango made them face each other and embrace. Then those white people wonder why the dance makes them feel so alive. Don't worry about that. Don't ever try to tell them. Just give them the music and let the music take care of the rest." It was time to go back to Leteo, to face his musicians with their countless fears. This new girl, Rosa, she had a new way of keeping the tango alive, and he welcomed it, even though he had no idea what it would bring. Because you can't cage the tango, he thought. And as he approached the service entrance, he suddenly was not 39 anymore, but 6 years old, scrubbing rat shit off crates in the conventillo, hearing Paolo argue with Casimiro and Sinforoso in the warm way of good friends. "Tango," Casimiro said, "is the sound of Africa." "No," said Paolo, "it was born here. Tango is the sound of America." "But it has the sounds of Africa inside it. Look at us. We have the blood of Africa in our veins, but we were born here. Are we African?" "Of course." "And our children, are they African?" "Why not? Argentina will never accept them as her own." Sinforoso shook his head. "Listen," he said, "you're both wrong."
"What?
What?"
But they leaned in close to listen. "The tango began with drums, and drums are prayer. They're still underneath the rest of it."
"Yes, all right. And so?"
"And so, my friends, tango is the sound of the gods." Thank you so much.